Welcome to the Turning Points Podcast. My name is Sean, and my good friend and co-host Corinne and I are excited to be here with you. We decided to join this platform because we realized just how much we enjoy talking about the spiritual seeking process. We both love exploring the mechanisms and questions that motivate a person to begin a spiritual practice. And we look forward to interviewing experts and authors on their personal journeys, as well as individuals like us who just love discussing these topics. We are thankful you found us, so sit back and enjoy the ride. Hello, welcome to this week's edition of the Turning Points Podcast. We've had a little bit of a break, and we had a new podcast after about 4 weeks of not doing any interviews. And man, Catherine Bell, who is, I don't even know where to start with her. So why don't you start with her?
Yeah, right. She's a dream interpreter. But she also, like, she had a degree in astrophysicist, but kind of, you know, but basically Catherine is the host of a podcast called the Dream Journal. It's a weekly hour-long live show featuring interviews with dream experts to spread information about the power of our nightly dreams. And we just had such an awesome conversation that we're probably going to interview her hopefully again in next month, and actually because we wanted to go into our dreams. But I had a lot of ahas in it. It was just a wonderful conversation, and I'll link all of her with the way to contact her and listen to her podcast. And she's had a radio show, all these things. And it's been her spiritual practice, basically her entire life is interpreting her dreams and helping others.
Yeah. Towards the end of it, after we stopped the interview, I told you, I almost yelled at you because I didn't realize we were as far into the interview as we were. And I thought we were only about 30 minutes in, and we ended up doing about 90 minutes. So it was just captivating. And I really enjoyed the ride. I think all of us had a really fun joyride, just, you know, kind of processing this whole conversation that we had together. So that was, it was really fun.
Yeah. Enjoy.
Yes, please.
Hello, Catherine. Welcome to our podcast.
So glad to be here.
I'm so happy that we found you on the Association for Spiritual Integrity website. Yet another person who's interested in ethics and so many other things. Mm-hmm. So we'll just dive right into our question. Many seekers can recall that point in time when they started to kind of question their childhood conditioning, their belief system. So do you recall when you became a seeker?
Well, that is such an interesting question. I've been mulling that over, you know, after seeing some episodes of your podcast and thinking about my history. And it's interesting because I feel like I've been a seeker for a long time, like most of my life. There definitely are certain turning points that I want to hit. But I wanted to start out with a dream that I remember from very young age. I might have been 8 or 7. I don't even really remember, but it's just like this dream image that's so vivid in my mind. And in the dream, I'm in this crazy town where everybody is broken, like at the waist. And so they're like walking around, hanging upside down. And yet they all have these grins on their face. They're like, yes, everything is fine. And I'm just watching this. This is the dream that I had. And there's something for me about, wow, people are really broken and they're just pretending everything's fine. And, you know, me too. I mean, I adopted that because that's the culture I grew up in. That's the culture we all grew up in, where it's like you hide your brokenness. You don't let that show. And so, but I remember this going, this is really odd. Like, you know, that's just like, is this different? Am I different from other people? Or is, you know, is something going on that nobody's talking about? Like this was like a grand conspiracy, almost kind of a thought. And it kind of like went in and it stayed with me. I have like 4 or 5 of these childhood dreams that just really stuck with me. But this one really goes to the point of turning points and childhood beliefs. And like there was a way that sometime after that dream, I kind of got myself swept up in the flow of hiding everything, hiding my true self. And I got so good at hiding my feelings that I didn't even recognize my own feelings. And so I got to be pretty numb for a long time. I just knew I was unhappy and that, you know, from, you know, probably age 10 through early 30s, really, I was extremely unhappy. I was very functional. I could get things done. I was in school. I went to grad school. I got a PhD in astrophysics. And so I was like functional. Yeah. And I can get things done, but I was just like, okay, life sucks. So I'll just keep going. You know, there's like nothing here. And I just assumed that everybody else was having the same kind of experience. But it was very unhappy. I was suicidal, you know, on kind of a low level, but, you know, for a long time. And it just kind of took, it took my dreams to really start digging me out of that hole. And one of the things that happened is that I think it was a huge turning point for me in my dream work and in my personal experience of life is when I was 42. I had a one-year-old baby. I was married, but it was not going well. The marriage was not that great, but I was kind of doing the thing like, I'm fine, I can handle it. And okay, now I got a baby and I'm fine and I can handle it. And I'm so good at ignoring my feelings, like my literal physical feelings, that I had a pain in my gut that I ignored. I'm like, I'm fine. It hurts. It's fine. I'll be okay. I was on vacation up in Oregon, and I was so determined to not feel my feelings that I ignored the sensation long enough until my appendix ruptured. Three or four days, I almost died. The doctor was like, you know, that was really close, because people die of that. Yeah. And, you know, it was a huge wake-up call, and I was alone in the hospital because my family had to go home because the rental was over. I don't know. Everybody went home. And I was alone there for 9 days in the hospital fighting for my life. It was touch and go for quite a few days. And I just really, as I started to come out of the haze of this, you know, all the anesthesia and the morphine and all the crazy things going on with my body, I just had this like cold feelings like, wow, I really abandoned myself. Like, you know, it's not, you know, I really was ignoring my feelings, and this is a consequence. And you can't just carry on and pretend everything's fine forever. So, you know, I kind of like ended up living the dream that I'd had as a little girl, and that was a way that I was broken inside. I mean, really at the gut, which is interesting. In the dream, people were broken like at the waist, at the gut. And that's what ruptured, was my appendix. But it was just such a wake-up call, because it's like, wow. I mean, it's one thing to think, oh, I can handle it, I can suffer, I'm tough. But, you know, I realized I didn't want to die. Funny that. Like, no. I'm like, wait a minute. And it just brought to light all the things in my life that I was pretending were okay, like my marriage and, you know, just this numbness and being unhappy, like I was pretending that was an okay life. And I'm like, no, it's not. It's just not. And it really woke me up. It really like kind of like shook me and went like, wow, this has got to change.
And that was probably in your
42. Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Yes. I'd already like gone through a lot of life pretending everything was fine, but even being a seeker, like I knowing that there's more and just wanting, like I did a nonviolent communication. I took a ton of classes of that and I learned how to communicate, which was valuable. I did a bunch of Enneagram classes and I learned how to like type people, and I was very curious about psychology and how to understand people, all as ways to understand myself. But I was just felt like a black box. No matter how much I was rapping on the door, I couldn't get into my own skull or my own heart. I was just like a seeking. I was trying to find a way in, but it was when I, you know, had this experience of almost dying that I finally like opened in me. I'm like, okay. The seeking has to start inside.
And that's kind of what I was thinking, is you were, a lot of the things you were interested in were sort of outside, which is fine, but it's like, if so many people do that, all of us do it, is avoid the self work until we don't. Now, were you into dreams already at this point, or?
Well, I've been fascinated by dreams all my life, since I was little, even like that dream I mentioned and some other dreams. And my mother actually modeled it, that she would occasionally come down in the morning and talk about one of her dreams that she had. And I was always like kind of fascinated by that. So I've been interested in dreams for a long time, but it kind of was in the back burner. I was doing some psychology sessions. I was a psychologist for like three or four years after a partner of mine had died, a lover had died, and I was really sad and I wanted to work through some of it. And I stumbled across this book by Jeremy Taylor about dreams called Where People Fly and Water Runs Uphill. And it's all about dream groups. And it's just like a light went off for me. I'm like, wow. Oh God, there's a way I can like explore these like weird things that would come every night. They get these weird images. And it just kind of like a light bulb went off for me. And I did have a dream group that I was part of for 12 years. We met every week. And this was even before my appendix ruptured. So I was still working on trying to go deeper, trying to open up the door, trying to find out what's inside. And the dreams were part of my tool, but it wasn't until I was ready to open that I was able to go in and go deep and really start to make changes.
Mm. Yeah. Now, how was, you mentioned you talked about your mom having, talking about her dreams. Did you have dialogue about your dreams when you were younger? Do you remember talking about, did you express that kind of the emotional experience you had when you had that specific dream that you mentioned as a child? Did you have dialogue about that, or was it just kind of, oh, it's just a dream?
I don't know. I don't remember. I might ask my mom about that, because in my memory, I don't remember much about that. But there was a lot of hidden emotions in my family. So I think the hiding and culture that I was dreaming about was partly my own family culture, where there was a lot of hidden feelings. My mom had a lot of challenges growing up and a lot of trauma, and she packed it away, and she was a good mom, and she didn't abuse us the way she was abused. So much praise there that she overcame that, because so often, we pass on to our children what we experience. And but there was a lot of holding back. There was a lot of ways when I felt like she was not expressing what she was feeling, because for her it wasn't safe. I mean, literally not safe. That she, I remember only one time that I actually got spanked, and it was like this. It wasn't that big a deal, but it was like there was some really terrifying edge to it. And I realized later that I think my mom was probably thinking, oh no, now I'm the abuser. With my own child, I was like always on edge. It's like, oh no, am I the abuser now? Because there is abuse in my family history. Thank God, not in my family of origin, but above, and all the cousins and everything we talk about, the abuse and how that affects generations of people. And so there was this real edge of, am I safe? Is it safe for me to feel my feelings? Or if I let myself get angry, am I going to hurt somebody, like literally hurt somebody?
Man, that's so interesting. It's kind of bringing to my mind that, the amount of fear and passive aggression and these hidden lives that we have, even as children. You're talking about a relatively aware child that you were. You were obviously present to your experience, and you have a memory of being present to that experience. And something seemingly small, like a dream like that as a kid, is a monumental, trauma point. It's a point of fear or confusion, and that's something that you carried with you for a really long time. And isn't it, we talk about families being this this safe haven. And I think so often it's really not. It's portrayed like that. And that is kind of, you know, reminiscent of what you're talking, you know, people are just ignoring the problems and calling it a safe space. And that obviously doesn't generally bode well for anybody, really.
I love what you're saying, Sean, about just saying something's a safe space doesn't make it safe.
Right.
And, you know, that kind of ties in with my some of my current work around ethics and ethics and spirituality. And that, you know, you can say, oh, this is a safe place. You know, you can share your feelings, but that doesn't necessarily make it true. And I'm always thinking about that as a leader, as a workshop leader and a coach in the way that I am, is what I am saying, am I really holding place for my people to explore what they need to explore, what they're ready to explore? I don't want to be like imposing my ideas on other people. And it's, you know, with dreams, it's particularly easy to go, oh, well, your dream obviously means.
Yeah, right.
XYZ. But, you know, we don't know. There's a saying in the dream community, which is only the dreamer knows for sure. Yeah. Like, which is funny because you have your own dream and you think, well, what the heck did that mean? And yet you're saying, I know what my dream is, but, you know, it seems like a contradiction. But what that means is that if I have a dream and I share it, and I don't know what it means, but somebody then says, well, maybe I wonder if there might be this happening in your dream. And I might go, no, that's not it. Or I might go, wow, that's it. That rings a bell. That's familiar, you know. They call that the dreamer's aha. And it's often like this physical bodily shift. And I might go, oh, that sounds true for me, even if I don't intellectually understand it.
Yes. I've experienced that very much so. Sorry, there's a lot of things that you said that resonated with me about, you know, safe space and that aha moment, because, you know, I think one of the things in creating a safe space is being vulnerable and expressing and sharing your, we'll call them traumatic experiences, or, you know, any emotional experience that you had that either kept you from seeing your truth or, you know, manifested in some kind of a negative way in your future. I think leading the way with being vulnerable is a great way to start with, you know, actually having that safe space. And I think, I don't know that parents all the time understand or feel comfortable being vulnerable to their children in a lot of situations, because, you know, you're supposed to be a leader. You're supposed to know what to do. And that was kind of something that I lived with, was, oh, my parents know everything. They're, you know, especially my dad, like that's the hierarchy, right? And then as you get older, you realize like they were barely holding on sometimes, you know, they didn't have it all figured out. And I know that because I'm barely holding on sometimes, right. You know, I don't have it figured out. And, you know, we think that is a weakness, because you're supposed to know, you're supposed to, you know, no, I'm learning how to be a parent as I'm teaching you how to be a person, you know, as a child. And I think if we were a little bit more honest about what's really happening in that relationship, there would be more of a safe space.
Yeah.
And then also, sorry, I just, on that dream
this
state,
is great.
That has been my experience where, you know, even when you say your dreams out loud, it's like, I don't know, even if I'm saying what really happened in my dream out loud, if I'm even accurately, you know, unfolding what really happened. But then there are those times, and, you know, Corinne, I'm sure we've been in the situation where, you know, Corinne would kind of, knowing me so well, be like, I'm wondering if maybe that might be the thing that's manifest. And then it's like, fuck, that is what I'm dealing with. And it is somehow flooding my subconscious, you know, dream state. And those are that's that intuition I think we all can develop, of knowing what's resonating with you or not with you.
Well, we can help each other that way, because we have blind spots, I mean, which are specifically put in place to keep away the really vulnerable stuff. And yet that is where the juiciness is, because that's why we're keeping it away. You know, when I do my radio show, I made the deliberate choice of being vulnerable. And so I start every single episode sharing my own personal dream moments that's happening for me, like, you know, what I'm really working with. in the next week, in the last week, in the dream I had the night before, then the dream I had 3 nights ago, and just kind of thinking out loud about what it might be bringing to me, and just kind of like confessing really what is what's coming up for me. And it gets to some edgy kind of places, you could but I'm like, well, here I go. And I'm hoping that inspires the listeners to kind of try that with their own dreams. Just think out loud with them a little bit. And then I think the guests are more comfortable sharing their personal moments, since I've already shared some of mine. And I do that in my groups too, actually. When I start a group, I always start off with a check-in, talking about what's personally going on for me. And, you know, I always have to do a check. You know, this is always, it's not narcissistic here. Like, I want to like share this bad stuff as well as the good stuff, because, you know, that's where we can really learn from each other, is by, you know, confessing and talking about the things that are difficult, the things that are not going so well, but that I'm getting clues, like, wow, maybe I'm starting to see how often I do this, and wow, this is really amazing that I you know, shut myself down or whatever it is, that we can improve the patterns. Yeah.
It's so beautiful. I love to hear that. A songwriter, famous songwriter here in Nashville, told me years ago, she's like, Corinne, if you write about personal experience, people are always going to resonate, because we're all the same. All over the world, we have the same emotions. We mm-hmm. want the same things. We want to be happy. We're vulnerable. We struggle with the same things. And so, and I think especially in workshop and spiritual teacher, even that community, that workshop setting, there sometimes is a tendency to have the teacher on a pedestal and think that they've got it all figured out. And it's such a beautiful opening. I try to do the same thing when I'm leading a workshop, or even in my newsletters, is just really share authentically what's going on, because then it takes the pedestal thing down too. Because one of my prayers every day is above and beneath no one, you know, above and beneath no one, immune to criticism, fearless in any situation. That's actually a Sanskrit, Sanskrit thing. And, so it's beautiful. I love it. And I love that you start your radio show.
Yeah.
Like that. That's awesome. So maybe we can talk about our dreams.
Totally.
At some point. Yeah. But yeah. I do, before we get into that, I do want to, because you kind of left us hanging with being in the hospital and being broken.
That one. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, for me, the big wake up there was to realize I was unhappy in my marriage. Like, that was like kind of the top level takeaway of what needed to change. Mm-hmm. I come really late in life to relationships. I mean, relationships are hard for everybody, but for me, they were very hard. And I had, I had my first boyfriend at 24. And so it was like everything was kind of delayed. And I got married at 36 and had the baby at 41. And so it was like a long road for me to even open up to that. But it was just not working. And I realized I needed to like build myself up and to give myself give myself a break and not beat myself up for beating myself up. You know, the problem with shame is that we can give ourselves shame. Oh, there I'm in shame again. Oh no. And then I kept shame about being in shame. And like that trap is really sticky morass. And so instead when I noticed that shame, like, wow, I'm really not telling the truth to anybody in the world, and especially not to myself, like to go, wow, that's really painful. That I just don't feel safe to tell the truth to anyone. And so I'd been doing these dream groups that I was part of. We actually, we did like a self-run group for about 12 years. And shortly after the time of my appendix, I got turned on to a group that was doing in-depth one-on-one dream work. And I started doing like one-on-one sessions where they would offer like total turnaround. Like, you know, you think you're being chased, that running down the hallway. Like, I had so many of those dreams where I'm just running, trying to get away. And they, you know, they start to ask the question, like, why are you running? Like, is there a knife? You know, do you see a gun? Could it be you're running away from relationship? Could it be you're running away from yourself? And it was just started to like kind of ask myself these questions like, who? What am I running away from? And then there was this another dream theme that was common at the time was like a cold gray castle, something really desolate. And it's just like I'm all alone in this really rock castle. And I'm safe, but I'm cold. And I just don't, you know, this. And that was just a perfect description of my emotional state at the time, that I was alone. I had cut myself off from humanity, including my own humanity. And I was safe, but I was miserable. And the dreams, and the thing is that to break that pattern, what I had to do is recognize the pattern and like really feel what it was like to feel so cold, and to bring that image into my waking life. Like in one of the dreams, I was in this cold castle again, and I had this like crinkly blanket. It was like plastic, like stiff, crinkly plastic. And I'm like pulling it up over myself, and it's just not. It's terrible. It's like it was not comforting at all. But I just could feel, and I can even feel right now, how sad it is that I'm trying to comfort myself, and I just don't know how.
Mm. Wow. Oh wow, shit. Yeah, because like you're saying, you know, you're trying to protect yourself, but you're not doing a good job of actually protecting yourself. You're shielded.
You're shielded.
Armored wall, but you're almost dead, right? You know, and it's just not really alive and interacting in life. And wow, that hit me when you said that, because I think maybe to a certain degree I felt that way, where you know we don't have the tools to even provide ourselves with the thing we need the most, and we don't know how to ask for it, you know.
Yes, right. Yeah. We just don't know. And so the key for me was to like start to feel my feelings, and they weren't always pleasant, especially in the beginning. There was a lot of very unpleasant feelings to feel, like that feeling of really being armored and really being defended and cold. But the dreams gave me like an image, which is so helpful to hold on to, because then I could like imagine myself in the castle and like the winds howling through, and I'm like, oh, that's exactly what it feels like right now. And it just brought a sense of truth to the physical sensations I was having, the emotional sensations of feeling lonely and unhappy. And it just like, it just kind of confirmed the truth of my feelings. And more, the path of the dreams for me has been learning to trust myself, trust my feelings. And it starts with feeling what you feel, even if it's not very good. You know, but it's also giving myself compassion, because of course I don't want to feel that. That doesn't feel good. Why would I want to feel that? But there was something that was helpful in putting the visual of the dream in with the physical sensation that helps me stay with the emotion, stay with the feelings. And so that I learned to kind of trust my body bit by bit. And still, it's ongoing. I think it always will be. But it does open up. And I just found the whole process fascinating of going from dream to dream. And I would work a dream or a couple of dreams in a session, and then I'd spend the next few weeks like noticing like, wow, there's that cold breeze again. I feel I'm in the castle. And like just noticing that and kind of comforting myself as best I can, like, okay, the castle, there it is. And then the next session I come back and there'd be the dream would be a little different. Like maybe now there's wars. I had a whole series of war dreams where I was like way above the plane looking down at this massive battle far, far away, kind of black and white, just distant. But there's like just some battle going on. And I just got to feel like there's this battle for my soul. There's some way that I was fighting for my life even after I survived my appendix being ruptured, that the battle continued on a soul level of looking for who I am and just this nebulous thing. And then I'd go and feel that for a couple of weeks and go back and see what comes next. And then I started to get these dreams, and they were there all along, but having someone look at the dreams with me is really helpful to really recognize these moments of light. Like, oh, look, there's something really beautiful there. But then I just go on to the next, because that's my blind spot. I don't want to see the beauty. I'm not used to that.
Yeah.
Well, so the coach would really help me to like recognize the beauty as well. So like maybe there's like a star over on the horizon or up over the battlefields, and I could like take a moment and just focus on the star. So yeah, the battle's raging, but there's also a star.
Yeah, that's hope, right? That is, you know, a signal that there is something outside or something besides, or an experience that can be had that isn't this current uncomfortable situation. And
right.
Yeah, that's a wonderful mindfulness practice. I mean, there's probably not a quick fix for the self-reflective process of diving through all the layers of, you know, in this case, you know, I think your emotional trauma sounds like it, not experiencing emotions, mm-hmm. not really being with emotions. And that's as traumatic as anything else, because it's behind lock and key, you know, and at 41, 42, you have your first experience with emotions from a place of awareness, which is actually funny. We were just talking about this earlier today. Corinne was talking about somebody that she knows who just had this experience where they were describing, they said they had this new experience, right? And the new experience they were describing, and Corinne goes, yeah, that's called empathy. they hadn't felt empathy in their life, really, or at least a resonation with somebody else's emotional state or experience. And that it's funny that we're having this very parallel conversation, because we talked about ethics a little bit before we started, and allowing people their experience. I'm not sure I've ever allowed myself to understand that people have a very unique relationship to emotional experiences in their own world. Mm-hmm. And some people don't experience them at all. Mine was not like that at all. I experienced everything. I was, you know, very dysfunctional empath. But, you know, what you're describing is this new arena of, okay, I can't live that way. So here's a whole space to play in that's scary and new and uncomfortable. And then you brought those uncomfortable experiences one after another into your, you know, practice. That's a beautiful mindfulness of practice. It's hard. That's fucking hard. That's a lot.
Well, because I was feeling something.
Yeah.
You know, it's like people who have cut themselves. I like experimented a little bit with cutting, you know, and it just wasn't my thing, but I, you know, that's kind of, that's what I understand why people do that. Cause at least I'm feeling something.
They want to feel exactly. Or actually what they do is that what the young people that I know is they, and what I've seen in some TV shows is the pain of the cutting is better than the emotion. Like they'd rather have the pain of the cutting than feel the emotion, which is something I've been talking about a lot recently, just because I've been diving deeper into some old stuck areas with some teachers that I'm working with. And then I help people as well in my coaching with that. And one funny thing I'd like is there's a show on Hulu called Resident Alien. And so this alien comes down and he takes over. There's a small town in the mountains and he takes over this doctor's body. So the doctor's gone, he's dead, but he looks like the doctor. And so everybody, it's a comedy, but it's a kind of serious too, but of course alien, not totally serious. And everybody thinks he's the doctor. And so he's this alien and he starts to feel emotions as a human. And the hardest thing for him, here he is, this alien that has, you know, the spaceship and all these, you know, advanced culture, seemingly advanced technology anyway. And the hardest thing he has is to feel the human emotions. And so when he's falling in love, he's like ecstatic. And then when he gets hurt afterwards, he's like, I don't want to be a human. This is terrible. And I feel like that's, but the thing I do want to mention that I don't think we've touched on yet is the reason why we do it is like when we go through what I've experienced in going into some of these deep wounds that I've found, because I've been meditating for 30 years, so there's not a lot of story for me anymore. Like, I'm pretty present all the time, and there's not stories for me, but there are stuck emotions from past and maybe from when I've spiritually bypassed before. And so they literally are stuck. Like, I had a shoulder pain that I've had for 25 years that is like almost like a stabbing wound. And when I am feeling something intense emotionally with a person, with either romantic relationship or even a family or something, it almost feels like a broken rib back there. And I did some work with this teacher I've been working with, Nicola Amadora, who's on the spiritual integrity site as well, and wonderful teacher. We went into that sort of by going into the body work, and it unwound, and like the pain disappeared. Like, mm-hmm. completely after 25 years. Uh-huh. And so I feel like what I'm, and I've sort of never, I've just recently been getting into dreams a little bit. Like, meditation has been my thing, and self-inquiry has been my thing. And I was so curious to speak with you, because it seems like dream work is your main spiritual practice.
It is. Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Oh, no, there's a lot of spirituality in the dreams, yeah, for sure. There's encounters.
And self-awareness, like, that's to me, when I say spirituality, I mean really self-awareness and knowing who you are, right? And it's
totally.
Yeah. And I don't know that I've heard of that before. So I love to hear, because I've been in the meditation world for 30 years. So do you have others, like, do you meditate? Do you do other things, or is that your main practice?
No, dreams is my main spiritual practice. And, you know, I'll tell you, Corinne, that I definitely got into the dreams because I wanted to be fixed. Like, this life sucks. And there's like something going on in my dreams that can help. And I just, like, it was an intuition, I guess. And, you know, there's been a lot of research studies to back it up. I'm a scientist, so I'm always interested in the research. Yeah. And so it's just true that the dreams, let me just do a little spiel here about the science of dreams, which is, we've been dreaming, humans all dream, whether you remember them or not, you still almost certainly dream. And that it seems that all mammals have a kind of a rapid eye movement period during their sleep. Birds seem to do it too. So if this same rapid eye movement that we associate with dreams is the same with animals, then dreaming has been on this planet for over 200 million years. So there's something about dreaming, the act of dreaming, that is incredibly helpful. Otherwise, we would have gotten over it by now. Because it takes a lot of energy. You're laying there in bed and you're like quivering and this and it's going on and the brain's all activated. So instead of getting this peaceful rest and, you know, replenishing our muscles, whatever we imagine we're doing when we're sleeping, there's something beneficial about these crazy visions that come every night. And it doesn't depend on us remembering them. That's very key, is that the dreams work just fine in the background. Just like our breathing. Most of the time, the breathing proceeds just fine on its own. We don't have to think about it. But we can deepen the healing effects by meditation or yoga and pranayama, different kinds of breathing effects, where we can deepen our breath and it deepens the healing power. Same with dreams. Mostly it's in the unconscious, subconscious. Doesn't matter whether we ever remember them. But if we do remember them, we can work with them or open them up and enhance their healing powers.
Hmm.
So
I mean, thank you so much for sharing that, because I'm just having an aha, because I feel like I've been in a bit, I mean, a bubble, obviously, not knowing about this. And I love hearing your stories. And funny enough, I've recently been dreaming. Like, of course, you said we all dream. And so I've known all, like, I've never really remembered my dreams much. Maybe one a year I would remember. And I was usually pretty introspective, like, okay, what could it mean? And I would get messages. Usually, once I remember, there's usually a message for me, which I love. But recently, the last couple of months, it's like, but like every night, and it's like big, like ahas, and it's like, oh my gosh. And that's like a whole new world. So,
right.
And I've been talking to people too, my friends and my clients and stuff, they've been dreaming a lot more too. Like, what's going on? Have you noticed that?
Oh, well, I dream pretty steadily. I have a lot going on because that's where I focus my energy. Right. I just wanted to say that one of my favorite references for this kind of thing in a very easy introduction to the science of dreaming is called Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker. It's mostly about sleep, but there's two, you know, this, Sean. There's
I heard a podcast with him. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah, you know, that's good.
Yeah.
Matthew Walker's wonderful. I think Sam Harris did a podcast recently with him. And he spends a couple chapters just talking about dreaming, and he just nails it. And it just talks about why it's so important for us. And one of the couple things that dreams do for us is they help us balance ourselves out emotionally, and they help us make decisions. And they all help us with ethical choices in particular, which is interesting. That the studies they've done show that the dreaming is particularly helpful in those three areas. But I wanted to also to talk a little bit, we can circle back around, but I wanted to talk a little bit about the spirituality of dreaming. Because I do think that the personal awareness and growth that the dreaming inspire is a huge part of my spirituality. But one thing that talk about being vulnerable. That I have I did not expect to discover is that there are I have, and it sounds very woo-woo, but
we love woo-woo.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
Our people love woo-woo. It's all good.
Not going to be the craziest thing we've heard.
I probably
the craziest thing I've said, I'm sure. So yeah, don't worry about it at all.
Okay, so there are different certain characters in dreams that come to me that speak with the voice of the divine. And they're often not recognizable as such. So as I started to encounter these characters, at first they were like homeless people or maybe trying to attack me, like these people chasing me. Like I was talking about running away. What am I running away from? And as I learned to slow down and stop and like connect with these beings, yes, there is an aspect of that this is myself that I'm running away from. And yet there's also an aspect of there's something so much more than me that I've been running away from. This feels like there's like, I sometimes think of these characters as like little fingertips of the divine, like that the divine is whatever you think of that is reaching into my dreams and wants to make contact with me. And it's like, I'll share another dream that was really powerful for me you know, my voice has been a challenge for me to speak, to learn how to speak and to know what I want to say. And probably close to 10 years ago now, I had a dream of being on stage, this, you know, lighted stage, and there's a man playing the piano. I'm wearing an evening gown. There's an audience out there, you know, in the darkness, and the lights are all on us. And in the dream, the man playing the piano is just gazing into my eyes. He's just playing the piano and gazing lovingly at me. And I'm just standing there, just taking it all in, like really basking in this connection, this way I could feel so connected. And there was a sense that he'd been waiting for me forever to acknowledge, to let him in, to have this moment where I could feel connected and feel loved for just standing here. Nothing more but standing here. But this was a very powerful moment, which felt like connecting to the divine. But even deeper, what happened is I was exploring this dream with a coach, and you know, we spent some time basking in this moment of like, wow, you really feel that connection. Like after all these years of feeling so unhappy and being in my castle, I finally had this moment where I could feel this love. And I'm like, wow, okay, this is possible. And then she says, okay, but then wait, there's more. There's more. Like, if you look at this dream, like step back and look at this dream. You're standing on stage in an evening gown. He's playing the piano. Might you be invited to sing? You know, it looked like Billie Holiday, kind of this moment of like standing at the piano. I love to sing. I love to sing. And I had not at that point sung in years. It was just, you know, growing up, I sing all the time. I was in choir after choir, and I just loved singing. And I had been a long time, and I had dropped that out of my life. And in this moment, when she said that, I was like, oh my God, that's incredible. Wow. Wouldn't that be something that if he's playing the piano and I could sing? And it was it kind of led me to a phase of where I started writing songs and then performing them like in front of groups, a cappella, just songs about my dreams, really. It was all part of the, I called them alchemy ballads, where I would talk about the dreams and sing about the dreams and feel into the moments of the dreams. And it became this, not a vicious cycle, they call it a virtuous cycle, where you feel good and then you talk about feeling good, you sing about feeling good, and so you're feeling better. And so it becomes like a feedback where I learned to like that I could feel loving and loved and I could feel connected. And the dream really opened that up to me. And I believe that part of that was like this nudge from the divine. But the thing is that in the dream, he wasn't going like, you can sing now, go ahead, start. You know, he didn't do any of that. He's just like so happy to be with me, just playing the piano. I love you exactly who you are. And then it was up to me later to notice, oh, well, there could be even more. But the thing is the unconditional love. I mean, that is such a feature of the divine as I believe it. That I get that feeling, you know, I wouldn't say often, but I get it regularly in my dreams now that these moments where I can just like feel this connection, like this moment, like, okay, everything's all right. And I feel like that's helped keeping me connected to the divine.
Yeah, that unconditional love and acceptance is that that's kind of a marker for whether or not I perceive this as whether or not you're actually communing with divine or some form of ego distraction, right? Because there's a lot of times where that experience gets masked, and let's say that being that's playing the piano, if you don't participate or don't interact, there's a shift in their reaction to Gotcha. You in that, and that's. I guess that's, I've had very similar kind of resonant experiences with that, where I've been duped into thinking, you know, it is this genuine being when really it is something that wants me to do something. And if I don't, or if I don't participate, then there's this almost a malicious turn and that double-faced character comes to play. And that has been a tricky process of walking through intuition and what of these internal experiences to trust. And if I may, because you said you were vulnerable sharing kind of the seemingly woo-woo aspect of of that. And I find that interesting because I think I struggle with the same thing where I preface that this might sound woo-woo as if you don't want it to devalue your worth because it's something that's so interpersonal to your experience that it might sound crazy to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And I've had those experiences too, to where it's not that I'm afraid to share. It's just that I'm afraid that it's going to be so far out there that it's not going to land with somebody. And so I don't share that. So thank you for being vulnerable with that. You know, it is, like I said, it's not nearly the craziest thing, and it's not crazy at all. And it's this balance between we have these very unique interpersonal experiences with ourselves in meditation or whatever spiritual practice that we're having. And because we have been taught on such a social level to be afraid to express ourselves genuinely, we hit these roadblocks, I think, a lot of time. And this podcast has been incredibly valuable for my experience in that, because it's allowed me a platform to share pretty naturally and then get comfortable sharing that pretty naturally. But we have this perception of what's acceptable to talk about and what's not. And we have these categories for things, and that vulnerable space of, well, this has got to be just me experiencing this. No, you know, I don't want to get too woo-woo because I don't want to turn anybody off. But when what really, for me, that was like, well, thank God somebody else is having that experience, because you know, that's your way of bringing that experience into an understanding. But I think we all have those. We're just really afraid to lean on them or even share them. And I think dreams, you know, dreams probably, you know, in a large part because we have some crazy shit happen in our dreams, very, you know, deep, vulnerable, personal things. And kind of to pull it all together with, you know, that the being vulnerable is a way of saying, listen, this doesn't make you a crazy person for experiencing whatever it is you're experiencing. This is what you are experiencing.
Yes.
If you're afraid to talk about what you're really experiencing, we're not going to get very far. And that's what we've kind of done as a culture is say, well, these are just things we don't scientifically know how to point to. So we'll just put them in the metaphysics category. And because we don't really can't verify that, we shouldn't even, it's like, man, that's a disservice to ourselves and to everybody else around us because we're not really having the deepest intimate conversations we could be having.
Sean, I love that. I've had several ahas while you're speaking. This is great. And there's something really important about what you're saying that I had never really clicked into having to do with expectations and that as a, that when we start expecting things of other people, then we like bring in this element of shame or control. That's a red flag.
Yeah.
You know, like as a teacher or as even as a friend or a mother, like if I have this expectation that that there's more, then I need to be careful with that and kind of tender with that. And that may be helpful kind of guideline to think about as we're working with our people. Like, can we be that unconditional supporter to recognize where they are? And recognizing I was in that castle, that freaking castle, like, and the person could have said, well, you know, you really should just come down out of the castle. I'm like, no. Yeah. I had to be there for a while to realize it's like, oh, yuck. Ugh, I don't like this. But I had to feel that and make that decision on my own. And, you know, maybe as a spiritual leaders that we can hold the space for our people to experience what they're experiencing now. Now, of course, at first glimmer, then we're ready to like make the suggestion. Like my coach said, you know, maybe there's something else here. You know, I'm just saying it could be like, but we spent like a lot of time on where I actually was, but her just like taking me like a one little step farther. I was ready for that. I could do just about one little step farther. And I was like, wow, that's right. Maybe I could be singing. So we want to lead our people just like baby steps, because mostly the compassion is for what is really happening right now, the unconditional love. And then if we get to this place where, well, you really should, then there brings shame into the relationship and it may like give us an ego boost because, of course, we know what they're supposed to do.
Yeah.
A red flag.
Yeah.
Red
flag. Well, it's an invitation to experience anything more about yourself. And it's like being that character who's playing the piano. It's an invitation to experience joy with that being.
Yeah.
That's it.
Right. It's no expectation, just an invitation.
Invitation, exactly. Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, I feel like I've one of my favorite, well, I think I preface almost everything when I work with people is, I don't know for sure, I'm just kind of feeling this for you. What does that feel like for you? Only you know. And yep. I think as long as we're, you know, because someone you're working with, they will try to kind of, will tell me, they want you to do it for them. And it's like, we can only guide and maybe try to shine the light a little bit. And like you started off the conversation with is the dreamer, only the dreamer knows, I think is what, yeah. Okay, so I have a question about, because I had this, vision when I was in my 30s that was very profound for me and life-changing for me. It came in the form of a dream, but I knew it wasn't a dream. So is there a category for that
it comes from the same part of who we are. So I would, you can work with all kinds of things as if they were dreams, even waking life situations. Like people use, well, psychedelic situations or spiritual visions or even like something weird happened to me today on the way to the grocery store, like that you can work with that as a dream.
I see. I see. Yeah. So you're using all his metaphors and feelings and getting the messages. Okay. Okay. That's cool. Mm-hmm. I like that because I certainly, it's so funny because I do that naturally with everything else, except for there was this block, I guess, just because for whatever reason, I just didn't remember my dreams for whatever reason. And now there's seems to be more of an opening, but I'm just fascinated by this. It's a whole new understanding for me with this dream. How about you, Sean? Are you,
Yeah, well, and that's, as you, I didn't, until you just said that, it made me realize that I think we're using the term dreams and we're isolating it to a very specific experience of life while we're sleeping. And, and what it sounds like you're talking about is that, man, bear with me as I try to define this. the dimensional space of, because you can't even call them thoughts because they don't feel like thoughts sometimes. They feel like they even feel like they're from outside of that space where, you know, your mind is just working. It's almost like a logic board. That's what thoughts are to me, where they're so repetitive and then a new one comes in, but it's the land of epiphany. Let's call the dream state the land of epiphany.
Because, that's great.
You know, that happens. It's weird how that can happen, you know, in such a like a three-dimensional way. So as an audio engineer, this happens to me in so many strange situations where I'll be working. So I'm paying attention, mixing a song. And obviously, you know, I recognize these thoughts. These usually they're all distractions and it's, you know, I got to do this or my chore list or to-do list or what I got to do tomorrow, blah, blah, blah. And that's my thought land. And then within that, there's that dial. I have it's almost like I'm talking to a whiteboard of beings. You know, you said you kind of isolate the beings. Mine, they don't say much. They just give me these looks of like affirmations or these smirks of like, really like that. I get more of these like kind of facial features. But from that land, there's this idea or concept or vision that just breaks all of the minutiae of what I'm doing, all of the thoughts, and it pierces that completely. And it's just this flooding of, it's, you know, people call it a download in a lot of ways. It's like a waking dream to a certain degree. And it doesn't add up with anything that I've been working on or have been dealing with. And it sounds like we can, I guess I can put it, dreams in from that land, from whatever land that is, that's where it seems like you kind of work in.
So this is great. Cause I think of that as the forest of post-it notes, like all the post-it notes. Like that is one of the functions of a brain. But my understanding is that one of the main functions of a brain is to filter things out, to ignore things, to not pay attention to things. And that, so that download happens when the filter kind of breaks down, when like psychedelics or when we're dreaming, actually they're very similar brain states, psychedelics and dreaming. And so that there's something that happens, the filter, well, the prefrontal cortex kind of goes offline and we start to receive.
Mm. So because we don't have those sticky thoughts and structured.
No, because that's all like the prefrontal cortex. It's like beta wave thinking, blah, 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 blah. But when that calms down, like during meditation, now you probably experienced this, Corinne, in meditation, that there's like that calming of the thoughts. And, you know, there's the sea of consciousness, if you want to go there. Like there's this whole idea of consciousness that, you know, we like to think in our scientific way that humans are like the most advanced life forms on Earth and we create consciousness inside of our brains. But what if that's not the case? What if there's this sea of consciousness that we live in and that we're all like flowers and twigs and branches off that sea of consciousness and we just happen to stick up a little farther than the rocks do? But the brain is filtering out everything that it doesn't fit into the day-to-day box that we need to take care of. But when there's, you know, in psychedelics or in these moments of, you know, meditation, when there's like a download happens, it's like the filters kind of dissolve and maybe we get to see, like maybe we get to communicate with that person 3,000 miles away because we're all part of the same sea of consciousness, you know. And, you know, maybe when we dream, we touch into that a little bit. Or when we die, like, you know, there's often a moment of right before death where there's a near-death lucidity, where even people who have had really bad dementia or, you know, other kind of brain diseases, that they get, there's a lucidity often happens in the hours before death when the brain's shutting down. And so that filter is going away, and then we're just open to what we're so busy hiding from.
Mm. That's interesting. That because we think of the brain as a powerhouse that is creating all of our experiences, or that all experiences are witnessed through. You know, we call that that's almost the God of our being, right? Our brain in a lot of situations where it's like, if the brain can't comprehend it, or it doesn't add up to the brain, right, it can't be from reality. It can't be a true thing. But that doesn't explain why we have so many experiences that are outside of the reality, and why so many, I mean, and I think to the point you kind of touched on, where this has been happening for millennia, where we biologically, and I think this was, I'm not going to remember the gentleman's name you just mentioned who has a book about sleeping.
Matthew Walker.
Yeah. From what I understood, you mentioned specifically about dreaming, but even sleeping from an evolutionary standpoint is such a strange thing we've adopted through evolution. If it was, because it's so dangerous, and it had been so dangerous for us to sleep, and it's so dangerous for all animals to sleep, mm-hmm, because of how vulnerable you are. And yet it's still happening, and it has not been erased from that evolutionary tool set. It must be an incredibly profound, you know, important thing.
Even extremely primitive organisms like, you know, like multicellular clusters, like paramecium, they have periods of sleep. That's so there's something that's like vital about that. Yeah.
Some exchange that's happening within, I'm sorry, Grant, I don't mean to keep cutting you off.
No, not at all.
Some exchange that is happening in that time. And, you know, we want to know, well, who is the exchange with? Well, mm-hmm, it might not be a who, it might not be a thing that we're exchanging with. And I think when you kind of sit in that space more often, you feel very much more comfortable, you know, like, I don't know what to call it. You know, you call it the sea of consciousness. We can call it whatever you want to call it. But that space that we're interacting with, it feels undoubtedly true. And it seems so real. It seems more real than even the physical reality at times, that it's not something we should dismiss.
So. I agree. I think there's way more going on than we understand. And I'm okay with that. But it's like, it's exciting. It's like, well, what is coming? What is the truth? What is really happening? Mm-hmm. But, you know, you really get that working with different people. And that as you see their dreams, that each person has their own perspective on the world. And I sometimes feel like I'm peering in through a little window, like, what's it like from this window over here? And it's remarkably different from person to person what the world is like. And because the dreams are so free form, they really can bring out a lot of those differences. And that's just like these humans in a similar culture. And like, and yet, so we're only seeing like little bits of reality, and there must be so much more that's happening, you know, as like, what do our dogs see? What does the paramecium see? What do the stars see? I mean, it seems like there's a lot of different perspectives, and dreams are just like kind of the tip of the iceberg, I think.
That's what I'm sitting here listening to y'all, and I'm like, there's so many downloads that are, and things that are coming together for me right now. It's like, you know, we started off talking about the emotions and the human being broken, and I feel, and there's this mapping that I give to people when I'm coaching with them, that this lady does on YouTube and on a TED Talk, and it's different than the usual mapping. Is she has people draw, because what she says is that when we think of a dream we want, that's that creative juicy side of the brain, the creativity, and we think about the dreams we want, and then there's the critical side of the brain that comes in and says, oh no, you can't do that. But when you draw, it makes it more coherent. And so you draw your where you currently are, and then you draw your future where you want to be, and then you're creating some coherence, and you're not letting that critical part of shut down your dreams. And I feel like that's what the dreaming and also, yeah, the dream state, because you talk about we get messages all the time, and it's bringing everything in line, like the emotion and the feeling and the vision about it. Because you think about it, a dream, it feels so real when you're in it until you wake up, and if it's a powerful one, it's like in you, in your cellular, and you're getting it. If you decide to focus on it, you're getting it in the cellular way and embodying that lesson. Where, as sometimes, as you talked about, we cut off our emotions. We don't want to feel our emotions. So when we go offline, the analytical, fearful part of us goes offline. We get these downloads, and then we embody these. And I think about all the dreams I've had, and that's what they've done for me. It embodies it, wakes it up in me.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it real, the whatever I'm trying to process or get through, it makes it alive within me instead of pushing it away of things that happen in real life. I have to tell you, I have to send you the song that I wrote years ago called "Whose Dream in This Dream."
Ooh, I want to hear it.
And I had a vision right after 9/11. It's like, because I worked with Deepak Chopra for many years, and he used to say, a common thing for him to say was, you know, this life is very dreamlike. When we wake up, when we die, this, you know, that sort of is more real, and this is very dreamlike. Mm-hmm. And this life that we live is more of a dream, he says, than when we, that's what he says. And I've experienced that in different spiritual states where this definitely is very dreamlike, this life. So the vision I had with 9/11, we had those terrible, you know, reality visions of people jumping out of the windows to get away from the fire and the explosions. And, you know, people saw that from all over the world, and many people were quite traumatized by that. And I was kind of sitting with it, and I realized, you know, nobody has not had a dream where they thought they were going to die or they were dying. Like, we all have those dreams. And then I was like, maybe those people in those buildings, it was like that when they woke up, it was like that was like a dream to them. Uh-huh. And that's what the song is about, whose dream in this dream, and what, you know. And so that may help me make peace with it a little bit. Maybe it was just like when we dream when we're going to die, and then we wake up and everything's okay. And like they wake up in their home and everything is okay.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's so sweet. Yeah. There's like a lot that we don't know. And there is some sense that maybe this is what they call the earth school, right? Like we're here learning whatever we need to learn. You know, my physics background, I think of human life as being a photon captured by an atom. You know, the atom has all the electron layers, and capture the photon, you move the electron up to a upper level. And so you actually have the energies in the matter. But then as soon as the electron drops down again, the photon goes off, and then the photon is free. It's not connected to matter. So that's what I think of like between the lives. Hmm. But the thing is, you can't change that. The only way you can change either the wavelength or the intensity of a light beam is by interacting it with matter. And so I think of that these lives that we live here, that this is our chance for us to evolve ourselves as energy beings. And that after we die, we'll go back to being energy beings. But then we're just being that one being until we get into a body again. And then that this is where we get to evolve, is as human in the flesh. That's my little theory.
Well, that it feels, you know, because it feels like a slow, it's a slower version than what's happening in the sea of energy, sea of consciousness. I mean, it's a density, right? I mean, somebody said that, you know, because the third, we say dimensions, but they also say the third density. Mm-hmm. And when they said when I heard that, I don't remember where I heard that one time, but that hit me so hard because I'm like, oh shit. The density, this feels that way. It feels dense. It feels slow moving, you know, as fast paced as we are. You know, we're as a human organism, we're trying to speed up as fast as possible. But really the whole thing, you know, and that's why so much information can, in a 30-second period of getting a download or having a dream, or, you know, dreams probably don't last that very long in from a sense of our time, you know, they're probably happening relatively quick. They feel like forever, you know, and sometimes, and it's like that's that much information can come down because it's not bound by a matter, by it's not bound by our physical experiences. And I think that's also, it feels why it takes so long to unpack some of these big trauma moments. You know, I was thinking about this the other day. I've just had this crazy move in my life, and it was a whole story behind what happened over the last couple of months. And I found myself like doing a lot of things that were really uncomfortable for even my family to understand and why. And, you know, it just, from a social backdrop, it just didn't make sense why we were moving and how we could move and what was happening. And from kind of my wife and my, you know, my kids, our experience was this was just what we're doing. You know, it was very normal for us. And from the outside, you know, it just looks crazy. Even, you know, to the point my dad at one point just like, you're crazy what you're trying to do here. This is just, I could see it just not compute in his brain. And I had this moment where he's saying that in a loving way. He wasn't being a dick or anything. He's just, he couldn't process it, you know? And I had this period where I was just like, cause I brought that to question. I thought to myself, is this crazy? And why is it? And should I feel uncomfortable about this? Should I feel ashamed? Should I feel a certain way about this? Because all I'm really doing is just, I'm just unfolding here. I don't know if this is the right thing. Cause that's what most people get, you know, they get hung up on. I don't know if I can do that. Cause I don't know if that's going to be the right thing I did in my life. And there's a fear and the anxiety of, you know, moving through some of that stuff. And I've had those experiences, but I'm just like, I don't know. All I know is that there's this force moving me through this experience. And I know enough to follow that force, whatever it is, as unknown as it might seem. That's the thing that I've made a commitment to attach myself to. And every time I follow it, it carries me into some fucking incredible, beautiful experience that's new and that's enriching. That's not always, most of the time, not easy. And I just, it just made me feel like this sense of, I'm just unfolding as this being. I don't know who or what or how to be. You know, I do feel that trapped sense of like, I'm trapped in this matter, but I can either feel trapped or I can use that as an opportunity to have the experience and transform that state that I'm in. And so, okay, let's go that route, you know, and that's kind of when you said that about the physics example, it's like, that's what it feels like in a lot of ways. And there's so many synchronicities to my experience that resonate with that.
Very cool. Yes. Yes. I think there's a lot there for sure. And yeah. I love that you've learned to trust yourself to that degree that you don't have to explain it.
Yeah. It's been a hard road.
Been a hard road. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
So, yeah. But I mean, you know, it's hard to put words to all these experiences, but it's wonderful that there is a community that is based in integrity and ethics and is open and has the space to discuss any and all topics. Nothing's off the table.
Well, just to circle back to ethics for a second, is I am a member of the International Association for the Study of Dreams, and I'm kind of getting my way into the organization deeper and deeper because I just love the organization, and I'm on the ethics committee there. And they have an ethics statement which explicitly states that the dreamer is the only one who knows what their dream means. And has some other things that are just basically protecting the dreamer. The dreamer has a total choice to share or stop sharing. And that just like in a couple paragraphs really outlines the real basics of what I would call spiritual ethics. And it applies to all spiritual experiences. This, you know, you have the ultimate decision to understand what your experience means. And this is something that I think is very important, and it's spelled out so explicitly in this organization. And I think, and they do take it very seriously. We've had a number of complaints filed over the years I've been on the committee where we really had to look at what someone was doing. And you know, we've had to make some corrections because there does need to be a little bit of oversight, because it's really hard to police yourself, because there can be a real rush in telling somebody what their experience means, or they can be like, and like people looking up to you, that projection can feel wonderful. I'm on the right path. I know it because I can just feel it. But you know, you need to have these checks. Yeah. So like, you know, I always say like, great, follow your intuition, but let's do some safety checks first. And I'm sure you do too, Sean. But you know, just the safety checks. Like, okay, well, just like got your belt on. Okay, good. And let's drive. So it's like, that's what the ethics statement does. And these kind of ways of really paying attention to the red flags we were talking about earlier is like really checking ourselves. And like, I see my own dream coach. I don't trust myself to work my own dreams. I know I have blind spots. I could go down a rabbit hole. That's not healthy. I have people I work my own dreams with because I want to like say, well, what comes up for you? Do you have any suggestions? And I get a lot of good insights. And I think that's really vital for anybody in a spiritual profession, especially a teacher or facilitator, to keep doing your own work.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's a great note to kind of start winding down on. Because it is something I mentioned to many of my friends who are teachers and the people that I'm drawn to. And I love studying and learning and have people that I, you know, can talk to that are mentors types. And then I'm mentors to people and just surrounding yourself, you know, as a check, you know, because sometimes you're too close to mm-hmm. see something.
Right. Well, in the ASI, we do the peer groups where you can talk to your peers, just like you're talking about there. That's one thing about the ASI. It's wonderful.
Yeah. And actually that's, I've been working with Nicola, who's one of the, we had interviewed her and then now she's one of the founding members. And then there's the other side of it too, though. You know, I'm sure it's not as common, so I don't even know if it's worth mentioning, but it did happen on the Association for Spiritual Integrity. You probably got that email. I don't know the guy's name, but he had a complaint against Rick Archer. And he sent all the members, as far as I could see. And then I kind of looked up what he was complaining about, and I was like, dude, is, you know, he's not founded at all. So I didn't respond, but it can happen the other way too. But as long as we just keep having the conversations and listening, you know, I'm a big one into just listening and helping people to trust themselves, mm-hmm. you know, people to trust your gut always knows. Uh-huh. And your dreams, like they'll tell you, or your people, you know, when it's like a mother's intuition that knows when the child is like feeling in your gut. And that's why it's so important to be in your body. I'm a yoga teacher, and it's very, you know, your body is this amazing GPS. And if you're not listening to your body, then your dreams will tell you. And if your dreams will tell you, then you'll get smacked in the face of one way or the other. Yeah.
Listen to the whispers before they become shouts, as they say.
Indeed. Yes.
Hell yeah. I like that.
And Catherine, I wish we would have got around to our dreams. that would have been fun too. But you really opened up like this whole new way of looking at things for me. And I really have so much gratitude to you.
Yeah. Just, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. And thank you for saying yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm really grateful to get the invitation, and I love talking to folks who are curious and open-minded and have great ideas of their own. I have a bunch of ahas myself that I'm going to jot down here when we're done. So thank you so much. I really was glad to have this opportunity to be on the show.
Oh, thank you, man. Great. No, that was wonderful. I like the path we went down, and thank you very much. Thank you. I'd love to have this conversation again and, you know, more depth and kind of, you know, rake over some of the things that you've been doing and some of your, I don't know, your approaches or, you know, through your coaching, you know, process. That'd be amazing.
Yeah, well, we could do one where we specifically look at your dreams and just to get an idea of what that's like. It's always terrifying and fun.
Yeah, it would be fun. And I think I know our people would love it for sure. And I will definitely link everything of yours, you know, in the notes, because I know people will want to, you know, find more about you. And I know that you do so much. You do your podcast and you have your websites and of course the associations you belong to and the workshops. So I'll I'll make sure I list all that. So
okay,
people awesome. Can find you.
Great.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Catherine, so much. Well, that went by way quicker than I expected. I kind of did, like I always do with interviews, I don't really have a lot of background and I don't know what to expect. And I kind of like it that way. I don't want to formulate an expectation. I like just get to the start line and just go. And I'm glad that this unfolded that way, because actually you did tell me, it's like, I think this is going to be a really good interview. You kind of had that notion from, you know, researching her. And so I felt that, but I think to start with, I think at one point you kind of came in and with this realization that when we were talking about dreams, I think our whole experience, we've been isolating dreams to a very small portion of our lives.
When we sleep.
And when we remember them. Like, that's the only time we really discuss dreams. Most of us, obviously for Catherine, she, you know, discusses this much more often. And I think you had the realization, like, wait a minute, we're not just talking about dreams from the ones that we remember. We're talking about this whole space of, I'll just say, metaphysical experiences, whether it's downloads, whether it's daydreaming, whether it's aha, whether it's epiphany. What we're really talking about, and it sounds like what she's working in, is in this arena of the dream state. That doesn't mean only when you're sleeping and only when you're remembering what happened in your dreams. And I think that's a profound realization that we're going to both unpack. But then I think it also, you made a really good point when we were talking about it, is when a dream is so powerful that it, like, it just permeates your being. It just hits you to your core, to like every cell in your body. It's not just a physical, it's an emotional and it's a mental, you know, full splash of whatever comes to your experience. And I think that's something that we also do, is we just kind of intellectualize, well, your subconscious is just thinking. And it's like, we really demean that whole experience. And I think there's a much bigger land to explore than what we have been.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've had judgments about it, because I think sometimes when people, like friends of mine, would be really into dreams and they'll start telling me their dreams, it'll be like a whole epic story that I couldn't give a shit about. Cause I guess, cause there was no really like ahas. Like, if somebody is telling me a dream that's meant something to them, that has shifted them, that I'm interested in that. But when they're just telling about some epic journey, you know, that they're really not interested in, it, to me, it's just like telling me about a Disney film I haven't seen or whatever, right? So, yeah. And also Deepak Chopra had said years ago, you know, most of your dreams are kind of, you know, your subconscious just kind of clearing things out, which yeah. She also said that, it, you know, whether you remember your dreams or not, it is processing and doing what it needs to do. So I think I've not really spent, and because too, I also have not remembered my dreams a lot of my life. And when I have, they've been profound and I, you know, I can see things and feel things, but it's not a big part of my spiritual practice, not a big part of my nightlife. And in fact, when I started remembering my dreams a bit more a few years ago, I almost would feel like I wasn't sleeping. But because it'd be such an epic journey. And I'm like, oh, gee, I didn't sleep. So you can, that kind of gets used to. So that's calmed down a little bit. But yeah, so I just loved hearing her wise interpretation of how, like, it blew my mind that that's her spiritual practice. That's how she heals. Like, she doesn't meditate, but obviously she's a very profound, wise, spiritual person. I mean, I hate to keep using that word because I feel like it sort of means something different to everybody. Mm. But to me, spirituality is just like self-reflective, self-aware who we are in the universe. That's my, you know, vision anyway. And I found her to be very much so that.
Yes. Well, and early on in the conversation, I think, you know, based on her story of kind of what made her really shift her whole life, and having such a, you know, physical trauma in her experience, and then her describing her process thereafter, it was very obvious that she had done some incredible deep dives into her own traumas, her own emotional, the locked up emotional state that she talked about, which is funny. As she was talking about that, I didn't get that from her. You know what I mean? Like the person she was describing who she was when she first kind of came into that realization after her appendix burst and she was in the hospital, and who she was, those two people didn't seem to exist on the same plane. She seemed very emotional. She seemed like when something resonated deeply with her, you sensed that, or you felt that. There was a couple of times where, you know, you could see she had a deep connection with her emotions. So for her to say, you know, she was essentially in a cold, dark castle all alone with a plastic blanket in, you know, one of the most uncomfortable and cold, you know, emotionally cold states. That's such a weird thing to have heard her say, seeing who she was. And so that really, I think that made me, it gave me a sense of how deep she is because of how much work she has done in her experience. And you know, I've really just her, you know, the whole experience of talking about dreams. I think one of the biggest things was, you know, we put so much emphasis on what does a dream mean? What does one dream mean? And she put a considerable amount of emphasis on the recurrence of dreams. And it's almost like, you know, her dreams resonated her emotional or spiritual state in that time period, you know, and that really made me kind of go back over, and it wasn't so much what I was dreaming about, but the temperament of the dream, you know, running style dreams. Because there was a period of time where I did have dreams where I was trying to run, but I wasn't getting anywhere, you know? And so when she was saying that, I was like, I haven't had one of those in so long. And that was something that was profound, was it's almost like the repetitiveness of dreams are saying as much as what the specific dream might be about as well. And that's going to make me go like rake over every recurring dream I've ever freaking had. Cause I've had a few pretty powerful recurring dreams. But what do you do with them? You know, unless you have an outlet for it. And I didn't know there was an outlet for it. So what do you do with them when they do come up? You know, we talk about it and we seldom remember them that deeply, you know?
Yeah. I mean, if it's like anything else, if you're not aware of it, but right. Wow, what a tool. And I love that she also brought in psychedelics too.
Yeah.
Because that is, you know, very much a vision, like a vision state, vision quest, you know, it's like when you think about all, encompassing all of it. And I guess, you know, like I said, like my prophetic dream came in the form of like, even though I was sleeping and it was a dream, it wasn't, I knew fully that it wasn't a dream. It was a vision of our evolution of how we started as humanity. And that I feel like permeated me. And should I tell it now? I guess because some people have told it before on this podcast, maybe on the very first one.
I can't remember. I know I've heard it, but go by all means.
So I was in a point in my life in my 30s when I'd been kind of a struggling songwriter in Nashville, and I'd been meditating for you know 5 or 6 years already, and my mom said to me one night on the phone, she said, "Why is it, you know, you think you haven't been able to accomplish your dreams? You came to Nashville to get a record deal and I hadn't gotten a record deal and I never did, but I had a writing deal and, you know, sort of the dream that I came to Nashville for wasn't happening basically. So I started thinking about that, praying about it, meditating about it, thinking, so a couple weeks into just like, okay, why is it? And I knew that I sort of felt like unworthy. Like I felt like even though I knew intellectually this wasn't right, I knew it when I thought about it, that what makes me so special that I could get a record deal and make a lot of money and travel around the world, like why me? And that's what was sort of cellular in me. And I'm like, well, that's not right, but that's how I feel when I was introspective. And then one night I was taken on this journey. Like it definitely did not feel like a dream. It was very clear. I remember being a part of a big explosion, and I don't even know if I believe in the Big Bang. Like, but I remember thinking at flying through the stars, thinking, wow, this is so cool. This is so cool. I remember how it all began. We're all consciousness. We're all one. And I remember being the consciousness creating the earth and oceans forming and oceans forming and then mountains forming. And then I remember being in the body of a wolf and like, I didn't even think that animals and humans, you know, souls could mix, but I was in the body of a wolf and then the wolf died. I don't remember like how the wolf died, but I sort of remember blood and then my energy of my consciousness leaving and I could see the dead wolf there that I was leaving. And then all of a sudden I was in the body of this Mongolian woman. I was the Mongolian woman and I was in this shack and my mother was on the other side of the bed and it was my mother from this lifetime now, but it didn't look like her. She looked like an older Mongolian woman. And there was this Mongolian man coming at me and I was terrified and I was like a young kind of girl. And then I woke up in my bedroom in Nashville and this voice said to me very clearly, you're a child of the universe and you deserve everything. And I started walking around my apartment shaking like, oh my gosh, I remember we're all one and we're all consciousness and we all created this together and we can have whatever we want and there's enough for everybody. And I wanted to call everybody and it was like 3 o'clock in the morning. And then I wrote about it the next day and then I wrote Child of the Universe song as well. And then I got it at the cellular level. That's what I was trying to say. It's like, but I have in other dreams too, I've gotten at the cellular level. Like, I felt worthy then, like that worthiness kind of question of what makes me so special went away because I felt we're all one. We can have whatever we want. There's an abundance of everything. Like, that was alive and well in me.
Go ahead. So my question was, did that change your relationship then with your dream of becoming a musician and having a deal? Did that change your relationship with that feeling of that's what I'm here to do?
Well, funny enough, it I don't know that it, I let go of the attachment of becoming that right around that time. It is like, I, because it was also around the time when I was learning to be happy in life now instead of something in the future.
Yeah. So when you realize you have access to everything, you find out you don't need anything.
Right.
You don't need anything. There's not that. That was I kind of baited you because I think I knew the answer to that question because the attachment to that dream causes the discord of the circumstance, right? I'm only worthy if I achieve this. And since I haven't achieved it, I must not be worthy. And then the cycle repeats. And that was your experience with, you know, record label with music. But I think that's, we attach our worthiness to the thing we're trying to achieve instead of your worthiness is because you exist. And that's kind of what that dream from my experience is saying is you are worthy, period. And you have access to everything. There is an abundance of everything. And that, I think there's two ways people go. And I think I went the way of, you know, oh, well, if I can have whatever I want, then I'm going to manifest this. And I set a whole new trajectory of things to achieve that I wanted. And I fed into that thought process of you have access to everything. You can have whatever you want. Well, then I just created a whole long list of wants. And then I attached to every single one of those, you know, and then, you know, but I think the purity of that statement comes from, that then we're just here to experience everything. That's what we're here for, is to experience everything. It is not for us to want. We will have kind of, you know, you will experience that. And I think everything then, you know, people, really, it's like, oh, everything, I have everything I want. No, literally everything. You're going to experience fucking everything. That's not always so comfortable. And while you're manifesting the thing you want, you're also manifesting things you might not want at the same time. And it just becomes this big thing. And so, yeah, that's what I was curious of, like, how soon after that did your trajectory change and your lifestyle change, you know, from having that vision?
Well, I was kind of in the middle of, because that was, I guess I was probably like 33 then years old. And my interest was starting to become more and more yoga, meditation, spirituality, less and less music. Anyway, so it was all sort of starting to happen, just happen naturally. Mm. And the letting go, I think the process had started before that, but there was still a gripping. There was still a need, this want to be acknowledged, yeah, and to be, you know, famous or whatever. And then after that dream and over the next few years, there wasn't that anymore. I still, and actually right around that, I stopped playing music for a while. And when I came back to it, it was out of joy and out of sharing and not out of ego need. Because I realized I was, you know, I liked singing because people would notice me and I would be special. And I didn't need that anymore. You know, when my cup was full and yes, it all became more experience, and it didn't really matter where life was taking me. And the spiritual journey was much more fascinating to me at that point than music ever was. Music then seemed to be, yeah, like I said, just a joy of it and however it showed up. Because also I was really fascinated with autobiographies, and there was, you know, some autobiographies I read where people were meant to be actors and singers. Like you could see their life just like laid out the red carpet for them. And I feel like that wasn't happening for me. Like life was not, I had all these opportunities. I was dating this famous record producer. I was, you know, doing massage with all the heads of the labels. I knew all these famous people and everybody loved my music, but nothing was happening. So I was like, something is not adding up here. So maybe I should, you know, so there was I was able to see it clearly and come to peace, because what I saw when I first came to Nashville and the singers we work with now too, it's like there's this, you know, the young people that come here that have stars in their eyes and maybe leave after 6 months. And then there's the people that, you know, become, you know, get signed, you know, and working in the business. And then there's other people that are like 40, 50, 60 years old, still trying to make it. Yeah. And that, you know, when I saw those, I'm like, I don't want to be that. Like, I want to be happy now. I want to be fulfilled now. I don't want to live my life wanting.
Yeah.
And after that dream, I no longer lived my life wanting. I knew I could, at the cellular level, I was everything already. And there's a great video I'm going to send you, and I'm also going to link in the notes here, called The Egg. Have you ever watched it? Mm-mm. It's called The Egg, and it's a 7-minute video, and it's basically this little it's like a cartoon that kind of looks like a little egg, and the egg dies, and then God starts talking to him, and he says, where am I? Am I dead? And like, yes. And then God starts explaining, you know, the universe, and basically he says, like, you're going to go and experience, you're going to go back into another life and experience, and you're going to run into yourself everywhere.
That's hilarious.
And it's basically about this one egg is everybody, right? That we all run into each other to the dip, but we're all one and we're all just running into ourselves.
Yeah. That's funny.
It's a really, really sweet video, but yeah. Yeah. Dreams, man. Visions. Like I'm blown away.
It's a lot, because, you know, it's such an intimidating, well, I feel intimidated by the playground of looking at dreams, because they just feel so goddamn powerful. And I guess I've always kind of had a respect for mostly visions, because I had that aha too about dreams. Like, I'm not paying attention enough to my dreams, because they're coming from the same place, same space. But you know, I don't know. It's taken me a while to really trust my own intuition, and have my own checks and balances about my own blind spots, you know, with the support group that I have around me. You know, I haven't really been in a confident enough space, not even confident. I'm willing to dive into dreams. I'm willing to dive into visions, but maybe I just haven't felt wise enough or discerning enough to do so. But there have been so many times, I mean, you've even done that where, you know, I'm like, hey, I had this dream, and you're like, you think it might be this? And it's like, shit, that's probably what it is. You know, and if you said something that didn't feel right, I'd be like, I don't know. No, that doesn't seem right. But there's been a couple of times where, you know, you've had that. And so it's just, it makes you go, it makes me want to look at that dimension of space. And, you know, and it's really interesting. Well, I think what else is interesting is our trajectories to a certain degree have parallels, and then, you know, definite not parallels. You know, we both have the music industry background, and we both deviated at about the same age too, which is, I always kind of found fascinating, because you said you were about 32 at that time. So I guess, yeah, it's been 3 years. Yeah, it's been 3 years now since I've, you know, left Elliott Root and left that, had that, you know, kind of trajectory shift and had that big, you know, huge life shift. And I think the lesson was very similar. But then I'm back into music, you know, doing more from the production level. But my why is very different. But I still have, that's why I was asking you questions about, did that go away? Because for the most part, I'm resonate with you with kind of how you described your experience from that. But then there are all these little sneaking things of like, well, you know, you could be this really, really good, successful, you know, producer, and that'd be pretty, you know, it's like that little thing that it's like, I don't want to be, that's not the trajectory. And I'm more interested in, you know, and lately I'm more interested in just staying in resonation with the thing that is guiding me through life. And it really oftentimes on face value does not make sense. I mean, us moving doesn't make sense, but from where I stand, it's beautiful. It makes perfect sense. And I get it and I see it. And when that happened, you know, I really had to shut off anything that might distract me from staying in that lane that was guiding me through that. And it was like this portal in life that was like, you can continue on this trajectory, but here's, like, you know, it's like in a video game when you find like a secret, like a secret code, and it, you know, shoots you through somewhere else. It's like, I think I need to trust that way. And then, you know, just a quick lane change, and then poof, and in, you know, 60 days, I'm in a completely different space, in a completely different house, completely different environment. And it has never felt more like home than anywhere. And I've even been at my childhood home helping my parents sell their house, because they're selling theirs. And, you know, so I've had these experiences. And you actually asked me before we started, you know, because we hadn't talked really all that much because of the move, you know, was there anything that came up emotionally? And the only thing that came up to me emotionally is I kind of cried missing, or because I was going to miss, was the studio.
Because you built it. I mean, and we have to preface that, but you built that house you were living in for only right. 2 years. You and Meg basically built your dream house.
Yep.
And then after that, you built a recording studio with your own, with no help of anybody, with your own yep. hands, designed it. And then you built a beautiful pond, and yep. it was close to your family, and you guys were there for 2 years. And then you're like, we need to move further out.
Yeah. I mean, the studio hadn't even been finished for a full year. And it wasn't, I wasn't sad because I was attached to it. I was sad because I had this gratitude. I'm like, man, this was a really freaking cool space that I was able to use and share. And I was more like a thank you. It was like a deep gratitude for thank you. Thank you for allowing me to have this. Thank you for allowing me to experience this. That was where that came from. But the house, you know, it was weird because when I was building the house, when we had it pretty much framed up and we were doing, you know, the insides, you know, finish work, I would sit on the stairs in the, you know, going up to the second story, and I would just pause for like 10 minutes and just decompress from the whole day. Cause it was just, that was just crazy time, just endless days. And I would look out into the rooms as they were being constructed, and they were just bare, you know, framed walls. And then they just kept, and every once in a while, like you could just see like, oh wow, they got the kitchen cabinets in now, and you got the fireplace and you got the floor, wood floors done. And then, you know, you just kept on seeing this thing grow. And there was a moment where it was just me and, you know, about 1 o'clock in the morning, just finishing up cleaning. And I was sitting in the same spot. I was like, it's like we never lived here. It's like we never lived here. We were erased from that place so freaking fast. It was like it was never really ours to have. It was so crazy, you know, and the wow. Just, yeah, the just kind of the visions that I've, that's why this was such a weird and unique podcast to have. Weird in that it's I'm pretty sure it's going to fuck me up for about a month until we have another interview with
what else is new, Sean? Well,
I don't feel that fucked up, but I get really just enthralled in these, like in the magnitude of our being and just how like it fucks me up because I'm just like, oh my God, I'm about to go question everything from this new vantage point again. And I don't say that like, oh, I have to. I'm like, I get to go filter the whole experience through this new vantage point. It's a blessing is what it is. It's a grace, you know, it's a gift to be able to have that.
It's so beautiful the way you're articulating it right now. It's just that mystical expansiveness, that awe.
Yeah.
That when people don't have it in their, when people don't have it in their day-to-day life, and most people don't. And that's what I will circle around to the beginning when she had that dream about the people being broken at the waist. Mm. Everybody's broken. That's, to me, humanity is broken because they have lost their sense of awe.
Yeah.
And they're in their little sense of I and me world and how I feel and what I want and my things. And blah, 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 blah. And it's so small. It's so small. It's like, I want this and I want that. And if I don't get this. And it's like the awe is just like, it's like just the experience of everything.
Yeah. It's mind blowing. And what I think like the biggest kind of like mind bending thing is like, I'm having the opportunity to sum up my experiences. You know, there's the saying, you know, you are not the sum of your experiences. And it's like, yes, but I get to sum up all my experiences and have them for whatever they're worth, for however much that's worth, however little that's worth. I get to sum up all those experiences and realize that it doesn't do anything to define who I am. It's having that relationship with the sum of your experiences. It's like so many things about our life that, you know, are so quote unquote important and so defining and so this and that. And it's just part of the river of experience. It doesn't sum up any of who we really are. And that's why it's funny that why I giggled when you said that egg thing, because like that's been, you know, you're going to see yourself. Come upon yourself in so many different ways. Like that's what it's been feeling like is when I even hear anybody talk right now, it's like, I think I know where you're talking from. I think I know and have experienced or can at least imagine the experience of where you're coming from. And I sympathize with you. And I'm not going to do anything to interfere with you having that experience. I will answer the questions you might ask, or I might, you know, play in that field. But it's okay that you're having that experience. And it's okay even if I've never had that experience. It's okay if this is the first time that I'm realizing that it's just this children's playground of, you know, it. You got this toy, I got this toy, can I play with your toy? You don't want me to play with your toy? That's fine. You know, I'll play with my toys over here and then you can have your toys. And like, but just that naive, very innocent, you know, space is just, I'm just so thankful for it because it doesn't feel heavy. It doesn't feel weighted. It doesn't feel bound to an expectation or an endeavor. There's just the next thing to do.
And that's so beautiful. I love all of that. But I would also, if you can, I don't know if you can right now because you're so expansive and I'm loving this so much, because this wasn't the Sean that I met 10 years ago.
Not even, because the Sean you met was the facade of something that was much smaller, that was hiding exactly what Catherine was talking about. You know, we hide ourselves, we hide our true experiences, we hide our full emotions, we hide our vulnerabilities.
And she even said she had abandoned herself.
We abandon ourselves to do the thing that we, you know, we call it programming. It's these, we're just wound up to perpetuate these patterns that we don't even realize are unnecessary. And it's a choice to carry out those patterns. I think that was an early profound thing that I had was, you know, and I tested it in so many negative ways, was like, well, you don't have to perpetuate this pattern. Okay, I won't, you know, and it's like, well, maybe that wasn't the right thing to do, but as you asked that question, it was funny. I remember some of the early books and some of the early things and you know what? That's really funny you asked me, because I was putting some things away and I found a stack of old journals. And I always have these like weird little conversations in my head. They just pop into my head, just conversations. It's like somebody saying, oh, what are those? It's like, oh, those are just, you know, my journals from my 20s when I, you know, thought I was hot shit. That's what I said to myself in my mind, is like, you know, it's so easy for that attachment to permeate your experience. And so I remember being, you know, naive and young and coming to Ivy House and being like, this is where I'm going to find spiritual enlightenment. And in a lot of ways I had, you know, I found a lot of clarity and, you know, but it wasn't from the things it wasn't from the places I thought it was going to come. And it wasn't from doing the things I thought.
And that's really, I really want you to share, because that's where I see people stuck a lot of times, is in, like, as you always love to say, the minutiae of the ego, which is the thoughts, the desires, the, you know, the vision of the way you want your life to be.
Yeah.
And that's a tough thing for the ego to take and that's why it's a process when I work with people. It's like I can't say to somebody, you've got to be happy with the life you have, not the life you want. Like, right. That doesn't help anybody. No, it's true, but it doesn't help anybody, right? And that's the beauty of it, is the journey of uncovering that. Like for me, I explained how it was uncovering that. And now you've just explained a little bit about you know, the grasping that happens. And so I would say that the symptoms, to know if you want to know if you're in one or the other that we're talking about, is basically if you're unconditionally happy most of the time, if not all the time, and content in life, then that's when you're not living in the ego. That's when you're living in flow. You're living in beingness. You're living in trust and surrender. If you're feeling like you're missing something in life, like you have regrets, like you have desires that you have to have in order to be happy. What else would you say?
You're driven by something, you know, if you're driven by something that has to be done,
accomplished,
you know, look at your value systems, you know, do you value the goal or the accomplishment over the experience of being? You know, that's value systems is something I've been really playing around with. It's something that keeps coming up for me is, you know, what is our value system based on? And that's, I don't remember if it was just part of our conversation or in the interview or, you know, when you change your value system from, oh yeah, I remember it was earlier. We were talking about, when you were, you put a higher value on like stars, when you were massaging stars or, you know, for a long time, you had this experience where you put them on this pedestal because you valued their time, their position over your experience. Mm-hmm.
Over
your health a lot of times. Right. Yeah. Your being, and so when you change your value system to, like you said, your prayer is, you know, above and beneath no one. When you value each other equally, then you can change how you're interacting with that relationship. I don't know. I went on a tangent with there, but when you said, what would, you know, check out your value systems and what do you value more than other things? And if you find yourself valuing, you know, objects or experiences as the thing that's going to give you happiness, just look at that. I think that's something I would add to that.
Yeah. Anytime you think that anything will bring you happiness, it's not true. Like the only thing that's going to bring you happiness is the present moment in yourself. And that's took me a long time to understand that. And so I apologize for it sounding cryptic to somebody listening right now, but there is 100% fulfillment in this moment right now. And as soon as you find that and it's there looking through your eyes all the time, it can't not be there. And as soon as that's your experience, then whatever you desire to accomplish in life and do comes out of a place of fullness and of our, you know, you don't have to have it. You're not grasping and gripping. You're just experiencing it. And that's sort of how I live my life now. I really am not saying this is going to be the way it always is, but right now there's really not anything. There's nothing I desire right now. Like going to Mexico and hanging out with my friend Carolyn and going to Canada and hanging with my family or being alone here at Ivy House, they're sort of all the same to me. Like I don't really value one over the other. I'm just always content within. So it doesn't really matter. I enjoy when I go to Mexico. I enjoy when I see my family, but I don't have to have that to feel happy. And that's what I wish to share with people in whatever way that I can. And meditation isn't the way for everybody. It has been the way for me, but I'm understanding now there's more. There's psychedelics, there's now dreams. I mean, and I'm sure there's a zillion other ways: mindfulness, being present, gratitude, love, chanting, love of God, I mean, love of family, all ways that we can find fulfillment within ourselves.
Yeah. 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 And, the desire word that's a tricky one because, you would think that desires, go away or dissipate after, you know, a certain level of, awareness or mindfulness. And I'm wrestling with, because I have like these deep desires. When I say like a desire, it's like, it's something I can't escape. It's not something I want to do. It's like,
an impulse would be a good description. Or is it more strong or drive?
Yeah. But it is a desire to do, not because it's going to give me anything though. That's what I'm wrestling with right now, is because the desire looks very similar to other things I've done. And so that's what's like, you know, I'm kind of on this spiral up. I am coming around to a pattern. And that's why, you know, moving out here, there's when I say a desire, I want to make clear that it's not because I want this. I mean, I think it's going to be fucking fantastic when it's finished, but I do plan on converting. We have this old barn that I'm converting into a studio, and then I'm going to have a common area, and then I'm going to build some little tiny houses. And eventually what seems to be the vision in play And I say that is because if I don't do this, that's fine because it's going to be a lot of work. It's going to be quite painful to go through that experience. So it's interesting when the desire feels the same and it feels like it's coming from the same place. But if none of it happens, it does not change anything about my being. So that's, I'm wrestling with, you know, experiencing the desire and allowing the desire to come into play. And, but what I'm wrestling with is the why of the desire. And is this something just because I want to, or is it something that is calling me to do? And that's where it gets really, boy, is it a razor edge? Because like I said, you know, staying in line with that force that is guiding me through life, the vision of what to do is very in line with something I would want to do for me or for, you know, and so they're so right next to each other that that desire and that call of action are so right there that it's just takes a lot of focus to maintain the why of all this and mix all the fear and blah, 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 you know? And so that's when I say I'm intimidated by the that dream state or that vision state, it's because they're so right next to each other. You know, they're holding hands, you know, moving through this, and it's just focus and then having fun with how that play. Cause one day it's one and one day the other one is, it's just like, you know, they bead right next to each other. And so that's kind of what I mean. So that desire it is the right word for what I'm experiencing emotionally, but the attachment to it and the intellectualized need to have this is, I don't need this. Like I said, I really would.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of work. I mean, that's the thing. And yeah. And you know, maybe your dreams will help you.
Well, that's what's going to be. Yeah, that'll be interesting. So we'll do it. We should do a checkpoints about this maybe in a week or two and just kind of check in and see what's up. But yeah, it's fun.
Yeah. It's a fun time on the planet right now. The veil is thin and intuition is strong.
Yep.
Emotions are high.
Super.
Experiences are high. And just stay grounded, stay present.
Mm-hmm.
And hang on for the ride and be in joy.
Enjoy the ride.
Enjoy the ride.
It's fun, man. It's a lot, but it's fun. So
it can be fun when you're not gripping.
Yeah.
It's better when you go, wee. You can grip if you want to.
It's going to go the same speed.
It's going to go. Exactly. Exactly.
Well, thanks for
love you. Yeah, man. I'm so happy to be back.
Yeah.
We're back.
That was creepy. Sorry. On that note, have a good one. Love you too. Bye.